Tony is an award-winning veteran business journalist, having penned the influential Chanticleer business column for the Australian Financial Review for 13 years. He's held multiple senior editorial roles covering banking, financial services, global markets, telecommunications, industrial companies, and information technology. And he's also worked as a foreign correspondent in London and Tokyo. Tony remains a contributor to the Financial Review. I would also like to invite the panellists for today's first session, State of the Economy, to come and join us on the stage here. Thank you, Michelle Bullock, Governor of RBA, Dr. Raphael Arndt, CEO of the Future Fund, and Danielle Wood, Chair of the Productivity Commission.
Lovely introduction, Joe, and it's my pleasure to really bring that genuine exchange of ideas about important policy issues. And I'm sorry you're sitting directly behind me there, but this is a fantastic opportunity. The first time the ASIC Forum has been in Melbourne for about a decade, and so this is probably the most influential panel you'll see at any conference or forum or summit in Australia. If we could just start with a question for all of the panellists. The Australian economy is showing extraordinary resilience, and it did through the COVID-19 pandemic and its immediate aftermath. So I'd like to ask each panellist, you know, what makes you optimistic about the Australian economy in the year ahead? And if I could start with you, Michelle, if that's okay.
Oh, thank you. what makes me optimistic? I think one of the things that I've become increasingly optimistic about is the labour market. Coming out of the pandemic, we have had, as the Treasurer actually highlighted, a fabulous performance on unemployment, but more generally across the board, underemployment, hours worked, all of these things have been really, really positive. And I think one of the really optimistic things that I'm optimistic about is the way that we have drawn people into the workforce who weren't in the workforce before. And women and youth in particular have benefited immensely from this. So I'm really optimistic that we can keep these gains. We've made great gains, and I'm really confident that we can keep them. So I'm optimistic about that. The second thing I'm optimistic about is that, again, through the pandemic, I think businesses demonstrated how agile they are. And I was really impressed with the way they adapted. It was really appalling conditions, but the way, the stories of how they adapted, they innovated. I wasn't going to use the pivot word, but, you know, pivot. So that for me was really optimistic as well. So I'm sort of really optimistic about the ingenuity of businesses and Australian workers. So that's what makes me optimistic.
That's very good, and I'm sure there'll be other questions perhaps from the audience later. We will have about 20 minutes for questions to get other perspectives perhaps. Raf, do you mind giving us your reasons? You are optimistic, I gather. We had a chat earlier. Yeah. You have the $205 billion Future Fund under your management, and I think $18 billion in Australian equities. What's your perspective?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. And it's a great question, right, because we're always talking about everything that's wrong in the world, the issues, you know, why we're pessimistic. But actually, Australia has a lot going for it, and the Treasurer actually did a pretty good job of summing it up, I think. And over the shorter term, so for us anyway, like the next year or so, you know, the economy's going really strong. Demand is really strong. Notwithstanding a huge, by historic standards, increase in not just interest rates, but real interest rates, which is what really matters. We've got a strong investment pulse, like it's been in the news the last few days, but the infrastructure spending, both in the private sector and state governments, has a long tail, and most of it will help the economy be more productive and more efficient going forward. And inflation, of course, is moderating, and that's in some ways remarkable. Like, I think if we go back a few years in the middle of the pandemic and we had negative real interest rates, close to zero nominal interest rates, and we said we're going to normalise rates to the extent we have, and we've had long-term bond yields in the US, for example, hit 5%, no one would have said we wouldn't be in a deep recession. No one would have said there's an investment boom going on. No one would have said unemployment will have a 3 in front of it. So I think actually all of us who are actors in the Australian and other economies deserve a pat on the back for that. I think in the slightly longer term, you know, Australia's fiscal position is actually really strong relative to other countries. And, you know, let's not forget, and I need to say this, the Future Fund and the other funds we manage actually are offsetting $250 billion of that gross debt. So net debt is quite a lot lower. And that gives the government the ability, if there is another crisis, to respond. And so that actually allows us to take more risk in the day-to-day to reform things to keep the economy going. And I think the superannuation system and the savings that exist in this country are a remarkable tool as well, and I think maybe we'll talk about it later, but there is a global competition for capital going on. Every country in the world is trying to attract capital to fund decarbonisation, to re-engineer their industrial base, and to uplift their technology. And actually, we have a lot of homegrown capital. Australia hasn't been a net savings country until the last decade or so. And that's a remarkable turnaround. And I think we have a lot of reasons why foreign capital want to come here.
Very good. Well, I look forward to talking about that, particularly what may happen in the United States should Donald Trump be elected. Danielle, you started at the Productivity Commission last week, and after a stellar career at the Grattan Institute, what would you say about, are you optimistic?
I always try and be optimistic. I think it's extremely important to look at the positive side, as Raph has said. I also couldn't go past the labour market. It has been, absolutely a huge bright spot of the post-COVID recovery. As Michelle has said, when the labour market is strong, we see that people who would otherwise be at the fringes, so women, young people, people with disability, people with lower levels of education get brought in. And we see that at the moment. Job ads, for example, saying no experience required, have risen during this period. So we've seen these people brought into the labour market, some for the first time. With that comes essentially an increase in the human capital in our economy. People are now getting exposure to skills and on-the-job training that they might not otherwise have had. And, what I really hope to see is the long tail effects of that. So even as the economy slows, inevitably we will see some rise in unemployment. When I look around the world, I'm actually heartened by the fact you can actually see inflation coming under control in countries without unemployment shooting up. So the US has inflation with a 3 in front and unemployment with a 3 in front. So hopefully we can preserve a lot of those employment gains. But really importantly, hopefully for those people, we can maintain that attachment to the labour force with all the benefits for individuals, but frankly benefits for the economy as a whole that brings. So that to me has been a huge bright spot and one that I hope will continue.
Thank you. And there are some more questions later about productivity, but Joe, just from your speech, it's obviously clear you're intent on helping through regulation to make the economy more efficient. Could you just talk about your perspective? I think I do gather from your speech you are optimistic.
I am. I'd like to... on my left, all these economists, I'm going to take a slightly regulatory approach, reflecting my background. And in fact, the Treasurer, in a really, really wide-ranging set of remarks, the remarks that particular resonance for me was the strength of Australia's institutions. And I think we should really take some pride in that. We have a strong Reserve Bank, strong regulators, independent judiciary, a strong rule of law, good values as a fundamental society. And they are enormous strengths to bring to the various problems that we've been talking about. So from my perspective, I really want to call out the need. Well, one, we should acknowledge we have strong institutions, and secondly, the need to support them to make sure they're properly funded and resourced and that they play their role within the broader framework. The other reason I think there's we should be optimistic, and again, it's part of our strong institutional culture and framework, isn't it a terrific thing to be part of a community that has such an open discussion and debate about the problems we're facing and the challenges? And so that debate is well informed and it's internationally engaged. So none of the issues we're talking about today are issues that we haven't engaged with our institutional colleagues, our peer institutions offshore. And I think that's another reason for optimism, that we're not trying to solve these problems by ourselves. We are taking into account the best thinking globally and benchmarking ourselves accordingly.
I'd like now to turn to the challenges facing Australia, you know, against all of the things that are occurring in the world. We've got, war in the Middle East, a war in Ukraine. there's enormous uncertainty about what will happen to the US economy. Raf, if I could ask you, what do you think is the sort of single biggest economic challenge facing the world at the moment?
Well, I think it's definitely inflation. Right, so inflation is coming down, as we've said, right around the world, and it's a bit more advanced in that descent in the US and Europe. That's because their monetary policy cycle started earlier, I think, and there's some differences, of course, in Australia and those economies in how the transmission works. But we've got this backdrop now of a whole lot of inflationary headwinds, I guess. The decarbonisation that's so important for not just the climate, but actually in many, many countries from a national security point of view, because they don't want to be reliant on importing oil from the Middle East or other countries. That requires a whole lot of capital, a whole lot of investment that by its nature is inflationary. I think we're seeing a political dynamic right around the world, and you touched on the US election, who knows what's going to happen there, where we're seeing more and more populist governments getting elected, and the nature of these things is more populist governments direct capital, intervene in markets more, not always from a purist economics point of view, and therefore they reduce potential economic growth, and that's inflationary. And then the other thing is the cost of money is increasing, and that also is inflationary, because every time a business decides to make an investment, that they need a bigger return on that investment. And so it's not that in the services sector workers don't deserve pay rises, it's just that there's a consequence to that if there aren't offsetting productivity gains, and so we need to have the bigger picture in mind. And so for central bankers like Michelle here on my left, I think that challenge will remain, and even if inflation comes down, the history of other periods like this, if you look back over a few centuries, is inflation does go down again in response to those policy shifts, but it can stay very volatile. And so how fiscal policy works with monetary policy is important, how regulatory policy works is important. I think one of the other risks that is just starting to become apparent is that central banks know what to do. They've done an excellent job, I would say, over the last decade or two in response to various crises. They've certainly helped us, after the financial crisis, avoid a depression, which would have been terrible. But unless we go back to some sort of experimental balance sheet type monetary policy, which doesn't look like anyone wants to do that, then they're only playing with the front end of the curve. And so we've seen in the US, although there was a successful auction overnight, we've seen that actually, there's fewer and fewer people who want to buy long-dated government bonds, it would appear, given the size of the deficit there, and that's going to suck in capital from all over the world. And at the end of the day, large parts of the economy and asset valuations, you know, that ASIC regulates asset managers, usually price off the long end of the curve, not the short end, so that's something to watch as well.
Well, Michelle, I think Raf may have actually thrown down a challenge to you to talk about inflation.
So he sort of stole all my thunder in many ways. I think inflation is the crucial challenge over the next 1 to 2 years. As Raf said, it is coming down. There is a bit of a perception around that the inflation at the moment really is all a supply-driven thing. Petrol prices, rents, these sorts of things, energy. But it's actually, there's an underlying demand component to it as well. And that's what the central banks are trying to get on top of. It's often said that if there's just supply shocks, central banks should just look through them, let them naturally decline and come out of the numbers. And we are observing a lot of that. That's why headline inflation has come down quite quickly overseas, and it has also come down in Australia. But if there's this underlying demand component to it as well, that is actually something that central banks can do something about, and that's been part of it. I think there's another few things I'd like to highlight about the inflation challenge. The first is the productivity challenge, and I won't say a lot about that. I'll defer to Danielle, but we haven't had any, at least according to the numbers, we haven't had any productivity growth in Australia for a number of years. And although wage rises are around about 4% in that in normal context of productivity growth aren't necessarily inconsistent with our inflation target, if we don't have any productivity growth, they're on the high side, and they're going to contribute to rises in costs. And we know that unit labour costs, over as measured in the last few years, have been rising quite substantially, 6, 7, 8%, depending on how you might measure it. So that's not helpful for the inflation thing. The other point that Raf mentioned is about the geopolitical situation and the fragmentation. The Treasurer also mentioned this issue. Prior to the pandemic, we were living in a world of increasingly open trade. There was arguably a big deflationary impulse coming from China and Asia. In a world of fragmentation and conflicts and so on, we're going to see more potential for supply shocks. And although you want to look through supply shocks, if you keep getting them, there comes a point where everyone just expects inflation to remain high. And if inflation expectations adjust, then that's a problem. So that's sort of why you can't completely ignore supply shocks when thinking about this. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I think it's a good segue to Danielle to talk about the Productivity Commission. The Treasurer mentioned this morning that, and he has said earlier, that he wants to revitalise the Productivity Commission. Can you talk about how you're going to, renew the organisation, get a greater focus, and actually, is it possible for your institution to influence this endemic problem we've had of low productivity and even declining productivity for 2 decades?
So I was really heartened by the Treasurer's words this morning and the engagement that we've had through, he talked about the statement of expectations that's been put out a week and a half or so ago, which is the first time in the Productivity Commission's history. What that really set out from my perspective was, both a statement of the value of the work that the Commission does, having this body that sits independent of government, looking at big, challenging policy issues, big drivers of productivity, going away, doing the research and making evidence-based recommendations, I think is a really powerful part of the policy frameworks that we have in Australia. And really what that statement of expectations was going to is making sure that we are really a world-class institution in doing that. So there's a number of different components of the way that we're talking about revitalisation, which is around how we communicate our work and package it up for decision makers. It's around the way we use data and the types of analytical techniques we do for all the data nerds in the room. The availability now of linked administrative data sets allows you to drill down and answer policy questions that we have not been able to answer in the past. This is a relatively new phenomenon, but hugely exciting potential to do even better policy work. It was also, the statement of expectations also touched on the sort of breadth of the skill set. So when we're thinking about big productivity challenges now, we're not in the old world where it was, relatively straightforward, floating exchange rates or removing tariff barriers. These days we are talking about how do we get productivity gains in services sectors We're talking about revitalising education, our health system, our care sectors. These are very big, complex challenges. We want to be able to give high quality advice on the policy levers that will make a difference. So we need to make sure that we have the breadth of the skill set, not just in areas of economics, but areas of social policy and other areas that will allow us to do so. But yes, do I think we can provide advice to governments that will help turn this around? Absolutely. I think when we talk about productivity, we do need to be careful. A lot of it is outside government's control, and I think I want to be clear on that. The rate of technological change, the way it diffuses, a lot of that will be really important for future productivity growth. What happens inside business is crucial for productivity growth. Are they actually adopting technologies, sitting on the best practice frontier? But government policy can and does make a difference, and really what we want to be doing is putting forward the best possible recommendations for government on that, and then continuing to advocate for them to get picked up.
And do you get a sense from your conversations with the Treasurer that this government is actually going to embrace the recommendations you make? That previously we might have thought the Productivity Commission reports were very valuable and very data rich, but they tended to sit on the shelf.
I've got a real sense that both the federal and the state governments, I should say, have an appetite to do things and have an appetite to do policy at the moment. And I think that's evident when you look around. We see some pretty big reforms on the table in areas like housing and migration and climate transition, some of the things the Treasurer touched on this morning. So I think they appreciate this challenge is real. They're looking for good ideas. By definition, we're independent. Some of the things we say will not always be the most sort of politically convenient. They may not all get picked up straight away, but part of what we are doing is shifting the conversation, saying the hard things, talking about the big levers that we think need to change, and over time, hopefully those things become more palatable.
Could I just switch the topic slightly to artificial intelligence? There will be a panel plenary discussion, number 3, later today. You may all know that next week marks the first birthday of ChatGPT. Now, a company that has revolutionised the use of data through large language models. It is currently going through its own existential crisis as the founder finds himself suddenly working for Satya Nadella in Seattle, which is a very different proposition to the one that was there before. But my point is, digitisation was identified in the Intergenerational Report as one of the biggest potential agents for transformation of the Australian economy. And AI is really at the heart of that. So I'm not sure which person would like to take this first. Perhaps Michelle, is this going to be good for the job market, good for productivity?
Well, again, I'd probably say I'm optimistic on this. I think AI presents the productivity challenge we were talking about in the services sector. I think potentially AI has a very big impetus there for productivity improvements. I think if you think the sort of things it could be utilised for to free up people, say, in the care, I'm thinking, so I have a daughter who's a nurse, for example. Are there things that could be AI could assist with to allow her more time to be actually caring for patients rather than filling in forms or doing things like that? So, look, I'm no expert on AI, I want to preface say that, but I do think there's plenty of opportunity here to think how can AI help to take some of these tasks away that gives people opportunities to do things that actually are of more value. That would be my feeling.
Danielle?
I'm also very optimistic. I mean, we always need to be modest when we're sort of trying to work through what might be the future impact of some of these changes. But AI, generative AI, is a technology which potentially has very broad reach across all sorts of segments of the economy, particularly services, as Michelle had said. So there's various estimates that about 80% of jobs in advanced economies can be touched by this technology in some way. This stuff is new, but there's some pretty phenomenal research coming out about the way it can impact productivity of jobs that are there now. You know, coders using it can actually double their coding output. It's been used in call centres, and you can see just by using the AI to kind of shape the conversation, I think it's on average you can get about a 15% increase in output in call centres, with the biggest impact on the newest workers, those with less experience. So, you know, that means one, big productivity kicker, but two, potentially opening up job opportunities for people, you know, for whom writing or language or other barriers were there previously. So a potential improvement in job market outcomes for the most disadvantaged. And then the really interesting component, I think, is, so one, we might get this productivity kicker across different sectors, but AI itself can be a driver of innovation. So we can use this to do better R&D, to improve the way technology diffuses, and that's really where you get the big unleashing of productivity gains. So this has the potential to be one of those technological changes that unleashes sort of successive waves of productivity gains across the economy. That comes with challenges and risks, and I know you'll be talking about that this afternoon, but it's hard not to be optimistic about just the sheer potential of it.
And Joe, is it something that could transform regulation? What are you seeing and hearing from your peers around the world?
I'm not quite as ardent, I think, about the future of AI as for all of its beneficial consequences. I think what Michelle and Danielle says is obviously correct about the potential upside of AI. But from a regulatory perspective, from my perspective, I think there are some very profound issues that need to be discussed. In the end, AI is data-driven, and there's a big question about the quality of the data that's feeding into these models.
I think it's called hallucination in trade.
Secondly, and I know we'll talk about this later in the day, I think we need to be a bit sober about how we approach this. From my perspective, and you asked about the international perspective, I think the regulators are still getting a bit of a grip on what are we dealing with here, what are the key problems. So from my perspective, just very quickly, I think what we can expect of AI and the issues that it can present, that really does go to the data and how that's used. Right back to the time of Turing, the big issue has been, you know, explainability. You know, how can we explain what the algorithm is doing or whatever it is the AI is doing? Is it explainable? And in the end, I would like that to be explainable by a human being, not by another algorithm. And there's some very day-to-day type of issues, insurance premiums, lending decisions. There's a lot of work that's been done on financial stability potential for AI or AI-driven systems to be disruptive of markets. So I think at this stage, the promise of AI is huge, and I really obviously agree with what Danielle and Michelle says, but I think part of my job, ASIC's job, is to sort of step back and look at the impact on consumers and investors, and that takes me back to the trilemma. So that in the end, do I let the situation unfold and let the market drive the innovation and any harms, well, that's the cost of innovating, or do we intervene and try to regulate it because we're trying to prevent harm, but then that has a chilling effect potentially on innovation. So that's all ahead of us, I think. Yeah,
it's probably also worth putting out, Tony, it's not a free kick. Yeah. Like, there's a huge investment that needs to go into it to make it work and be productive, not just in the technology, but in the infrastructure that supports it. So we've got something like $4 billion directly invested in AI companies through the venture program, but it's four times that if we add our investment in data centres, communications, infrastructure around the world. And the orders that the big tech companies have just put in for data centres are like 4 to 10 times what they thought 2 years ago, right around the world. And that compute power does not exist. And so finding places in the world where you can put it, on the nodes, building the communication infrastructure, finding the labour you're going to need, the water demands from an environmental point of view, the energy demands, these are not small problems.
And what's your take on Sam Altman is the founder of OpenAI, which then was invested in by Microsoft and now is being apparently wooed by Microsoft to solve a problem there. What's your take on what's going on there? And do you see any parallel with the huge divisions in the United States at the moment?
So I only know what I've read in the newspaper overnight, but you know, it would appear to me that what we've got is a company that was founded on a dream and a promise about being scientifically pure that's actually being backed by venture capitalists, or in this case, you know, Microsoft, a listed company that has shareholders to be responsible for. And there appears to have been a schism about where to focus there. As I was saying before, it's nice to be purist, and I think we need regulators and others to ensure that we don't step beyond some line that we think is a step too far, but the capital has to come from private savers, private investors that will need return on that investment. And so I think what we're seeing probably is that play out in the US.
So that's a conflict between almost what you might say an altruistic, charity-driven organisation, which a shareholder is Elon Musk, needing capital and the CEO wanting the capital and ending up in the arms of one of the world's biggest companies. What's the parallel with what's happening with Donald Trump and the divisions in America? This is like the left and the right splitting down the middle, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so at the Future Fund, we've published a couple of discussion papers over the last 2 years talking about, we call it a new investment order, but it really comes from the difference in equity in outcomes for different generations across the world. And I think most people who are under 40 or 45 have had a very different life experience to older people. They have a different access to wealth. They have a different access to various types of life outcomes, and they're not very happy about that. And they're starting to exercise that at the ballot box in democracies. And that's what I was talking about before. And so I think what we're seeing in the US is an extreme example where different people in different situations are getting different life outcomes, and that country is saying that's not good enough and it will be resolved eventually, let's hope peacefully. But, you know, it's a country that unfortunately has gone down various paths of conflict in its history. So it is quite a dangerous point in history, I think, next year, that US election. You know, someone told me last week that there's a pretty public process underway by the Trump campaign to identify and replace every senior position in the US public service that they can.
I think it's 25,000 people, isn't it?
Something like that, Project 25, I think they call it.
Blue Book's 4,000 to 8,000, the change of administration.
You know, and that's a legitimate right of a new government in that country that's elected, but it will be a profound impact of the direction of what is the biggest economy in the world, the biggest military in the world, and that's something we have to take seriously.
Well, now I'm just going to ask each panellist one last question before we go to questions from the floor. And you can lodge your questions through the app and they will come up here in front of me, or preferably we can get human beings with a microphone to actually, there'll be seven or eight roving microphones. So just one question for you, Danielle. I read in the Financial Review that you last week indicated support for comprehensive reform of the tax system. Could you elaborate?
Tax is the issue that just keeps following me around. Look, I've spoken about tax a lot in my previous role at Grattan. I've been very clear. I think it's important. It's an important lever governments have. You know, the way we collect tax has implications for productivity, incentives to invest and earn money. It also is really important for questions of long-run budget sustainability, and the Treasurer touched on that this morning. We do have a longer-term challenge of some pretty fast-growing expenditure areas, and you know, I think we have to have a conversation about, you know, both the tax and spending sides of the budget. So that was the kind of context in which those comments were made. You know, we will look at that at the Productivity Commission if we were asked to, as per the normal process. The government sends us inquiry on particular topics. I do think, just to make a sort of broader comment about tax in the public debate, often we use tax and IR as kind of shorthands for serious economic reform. You know, you're not a reformer if you're not doing tax policy. Those levers are really important, but there's a whole range of really other important levers as well, as I touched on before. So, you know, the way we respond to the green transition, what we're doing in services sectors, the way we're meeting the challenge of the digital revolution, you know, those are all really critical levers as well. And I think sometimes we need to make sure that we're having a holistic conversation about economic reform and recognising those other things as genuine economic reforms as well. And you know, if you're not doing tax, you're not serious. I don't think that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Michelle, under your leadership, how will the new governance model at the RBA affect in any way, if at all, your ability to align monetary policy to ensure short-term stability and long-term sustainability of the economy?
I think it'll help us. I think the focus of the review has been on having a board that is much more focused on monetary policy and having more ability to... you might have seen that we've recently appointed a chief communications officer, so we're actually going to uplift our communications. Danielle spoke about that earlier. We'll have a governance board which will be assisting in the running of the bank, because people forget that actually most of the bank is not in policy. Most of the Reserve Bank is actually in operations. We have about half the bank is in IT. Because we run payment systems, we run banking, we do all these sorts of things. So there's a big operational burden on the governor and the deputy governor. And so I think the governance board and the chief operating officer are going to help us, and it'll help us to focus. We can leave someone else, we'll still be responsible. We'll have someone else to focus on some of that and a board to focus on that, and we can focus more on monetary policy.
Okay. Joe, could we expect these challenging times to lead to more regulation? You mentioned AI might be something we need to be concerned about, and perhaps there's need to be introduction of principles about ethics that are applied to every AI program. But is it possible to still get an efficient economy with these challenges?
Well, I think what we're really talking about is a modern state. I mean, if history, certainly the last 30 years, tells us anything, regulation is going to be a constant feature of our lives, and all of the issues that we've been touching on will always have a regulatory aspect. So in my remarks, you know, we've got a whole lot of new regulation coming our way. We know it's coming because it's been announced. You know, the crypto regulation is a good example. There may very well be some new forms of regulation that AI will, aspects of AI will encourage. But I think these modern circumstances, particularly the way RAF very well put them, that there's a massive renegotiation or reanalysis of the role of the state in people's lives. And so Martin Wolf's written about this, you know, the crisis in democratic capitalism. The fact of the matter is, as RAF said, a lot of people are feeling left behind. We have a big inequality issue, hopefully not as big as the US, throughout the world in the democracies. And so that's a big issue that we need to figure out what the policy and regulatory settings are that are going to deliver for a whole lot of people who feel, you know, they've just been left behind. And so I think regulation is going to be a constant feature of that. Yeah.
And finally, RAF, you recently visited Japan. You had the privilege of meeting the Prime Minister and half a dozen ministers in the government. Can you tell us what was your biggest takeaway from that, and how would it relate back to Australia? Yeah.
So I was talking before about the global competition for capital, and I think governments around the world are starting to run structured, organised programs to attract large capital investors, large pension funds, sovereign funds, the future funds, one of those representing Australia, to try to attract capital into their programs that are national strategic priorities, so decarbonisation, AI, critical minerals extraction, new industrialisation, these type of things. And so Japan's really quite interesting because it's been in this sort of malaise for decades, and most of us, especially older people, will just write it off because our knowledge of Japan is that returns are zero, inflation zero, population's declining. But the government there has woken up to that. And the thing that Japan has going for it, a few things. So one, it's not China, but it's a developed economy with a skilled workforce in that region. And so actually from the reshoring or readjusting or friendshoring of supply chains, it's actually attracting a lot of global investment right now from countries and companies that don't want to keep investing in their Chinese supply chains. Secondly, it has a huge savings base. And so that's been dismissed globally for decades because returns were zero, Japanese household savings were directed offshore to somewhere where returns were better, or to JGBs where returns were zero. But the Bank of Japan's pretty deliberate now in allowing inflation to pick up, and it's not high by global standards, but it's certainly very high by Japanese standards. And they've got a really clear program of trying to improve corporate governance in their listed companies, to unwind cross-ownership provisions or delist companies, to drive return on equity, and to change the tax system to encourage Japanese households to invest in risky assets in Japan. And if that's successful, and it's an if because governments in Japan for a long time have tried these things and they haven't been so successful, that could fundamentally change the nature of investing into Japan. We certainly think that. We've had an overweight to Japan for some years, and the Japanese equity market's the highest performing in the world, really, over a few years. But the critical thing to understand here, there's a global competition for capital. The Japanese government understands it and is acting on it.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, it's a pity the Future Fund doesn't offer an open offer, a superannuation fund, because from the sounds of things, you know how to pick markets. Now, is there someone who would like to open the batting for questions? A sort of a Travis Head, hit it out of the park. Six question, or, oh yes, over there, Mr. James Thompson from the Australian Financial Review. There will be a microphone coming over to you. Just wait on, James. I think we might get another microphone because nobody can hear you unless I repeat it. So there's a technician coming over. Actually, why don't you come up to the lectern and just... Like to take that?
I'm actually not 100% sure what the question
was. So the question is that...
Well, we saw really big moves pretty quickly, right, when the crisis hit.
Oh, okay,
this
I see.
This is a slow-motion crisis, but everyone says it is happening. This is what's... So why are essentially our institutions being so timid when what is required is probably going to be as substantial or more than what occurred within weeks and months when COVID hit?
Okay.
Well, I suppose this has two legs to it. One is the speeches that have been made by Philip Lowe in the past that if we don't, and I don't want to answer the question, but I think this is the context, that if we do not take enough action fast enough, the impact on the economy will be so great, there will be disorder in the economy. Did you agree with that?
Well, I guess I'd make a couple of points. First of all, interest rates can't address that issue, right? So We can lower interest rates dramatically at the beginning of a pandemic and we can increase them when inflation goes up, but we can't do anything. Having said that, I think we are moving. I think the current government has taken very firm steps in this direction now, and I think that's been really important because it's given certainty to businesses. People know the direction we're heading now, whereas there was a lot of uncertainty. I know the regulators are working through the Council of Financial Regulators. We're working on issues to do with disclosure. Joe talked about some of these issues. So I think the institutions, at least that on the financial side, are working on it. I can't speak for the others, but I think we are moving. So that would be my response.
And can we get a microphone to James Thompson? Is there some? I know there's seven microphones in the room, but one of them's got to work. Yes, look, please yell.
So, obviously we've seen a big shock to the economy from immigration this year. The numbers are 500,000, maybe 600,000 on an annualised rate. That creates some short-term pressures on the economy. Are there long-term gains from immigration? Probably for Michelle and Danielle.
So the answer is yes, there are long-term gains from a strong migration program in Australia. Historically, it has run a strong program by developed country standards. So the gains, particularly in our skilled migration program, are around bringing in talent from overseas. There's spillover benefits in doing so. There's also fiscal dividends in order to do that. But we need to make sure, first of all, that we are maximising the benefits to the Australian economy from that program. And my former colleagues at the Grattan Institute had done a lot of work thinking about how do we make sure we're getting the best bang for buck from skilled migration? How are we making sure that that program selects those migrants that are going to deliver those benefits for the economy? And I think the government's actually going down a positive path here with the migration review, really considering some of those issues because this is an important productivity lever. The second component is really just the way in which migration has come back at speed post-COVID and hit into particularly housing markets where we'd had another shock which had led to a decline in household size. So we'd had this increase in domestic demand for housing. With the large migration program, obviously that has created some challenges. The right answer there, I think, is first of all to improve housing supply. We need to be actually building the capacity to absorb that size of the migration intake, and there is what I think is some pretty positive signs of movement there from state governments. There is a secondary question around the kind of temporary migration intake. A lot of it is students. We did expand the amount of time that students could stay after they finished their degree. There's a question mark about whether that was the right policy and whether, you're keeping people here for longer, which increases the size of the intake, where they don't necessarily have a long-term path to permanency. So I think there's probably some policy work around the temporary migration settings that we'll need to shift as well.
Did you want to say anything,
Michelle? No, I think Danielle's covered it off well. I just did want to highlight, though, that it is the current surge in migration is a catch-up from... and we're basically going to get back up to our trend where we were before. So there's been a massive increase, basically, all these students in particular, who are coming back and they're not leaving. So there will be a point at which there will start to be an outflow as well. So I agree that ultimately it's beneficial. The challenge at the moment is the infrastructure isn't there. The housing market in particular is an example of that. Immigration adds to both supply and demand. People sort of... Different people focus on different things. So during the pandemic, when there was a shortage of labour, I had a lot of businesses saying to me, we need migration to get... And I say, well, yes, that's true, but then that adds to demand as well. And now we've got the opposite. People are forgetting about the supply and they're saying, oh, all it's doing is adding to demand. Well, no, it's actually adding to supply as well. So I just want people to keep that in mind when you think about the impacts of migration on the economy.
Thank you. We have a question that's come through on the app, and it says that the Australian economy has been remarkably resilient and labour market is strong, but in the last year, the standard of living for most Australians, brackets, except baby boomers, close brackets, thank you for that, are not impacted by rate rises. How do you think of that challenge, Michelle? Sorry, the question just flipped. But it basically said we're in a GDP recession, which I don't actually understand that term. But
no, I don't either. So I think standard of living, what I'm going to interpret was meant by that question is real wages. And it's true that real wages have declined. And they have because inflation has been high. So I think this just demonstrates the reason why we need to get inflation back down. It's because ultimately, low and stable inflation, it's good for employment, it's good for people's pay packets, their real wages, and it's good for the Australian economy. So that would be my response. It hits the nail on the head. Yes, it's not desirable. That's why inflation has to come down.
Now, there's a lady just behind James Thompson.
Yes, can you hear me?
You may have to speak a bit louder.
Right, okay. Anne O'Donnell, and I'm not a journalist, I'm not executive director. I just want to ask a question about, in terms of macro risk and world economy, one of the things I worry about is the increasing disregard for the rule of law and also the ability to manipulate, thank you, that's easy, to manipulate truth, so like the rise of alternative facts. And I would just be interested in the panel's thoughts in terms of that as a sort of macro risk, whether that is something you worry about. I'd be very happy to be told that I'm wasting my brain cells worrying about that, but I'm just interested in your views. Did you hear the first part of it?
Look, I think we understand what you're saying. I mean, for example, one of the most popular social media platforms in America is TikTok. Which is owned by the Chinese. Now, Washington doesn't want to do anything to disturb that company's success because it is basically playing to Generation XYZ. It's one of their favourite tools for communicating. Does anyone want to talk about the potential for disinformation through social media and other forms of communication outside?
Well, it's profound, isn't it? I mean, in my world, the world of influencers, social media, and AI will turbocharge this. The amount of misleading and deceptive material that consumers and investors are exposed to is enormous. So I think it's we're living in a post-truth world. So I think it fundamentally erodes any democracy, and it fundamentally erodes the rule of law and getting things done if we can't even agree on what the facts are. So I think I talked about greenwashing as sort of a major priority for ASIC at the moment, but that's an example, isn't it, where you've got a misleading and deceptive conduct in connection with an activity that's really quite fundamental to what a lot of us want to do in our investments and in our choices when we're engaging with the economy.
Can I follow up on this? We're seeing at the moment Mrs. Gina Reinhart and Dr. Andrew Forrest have both sued Meta to stop them putting their images attached to scams. And the company is just ignoring them. This is quite amazing. These people have deep pockets, but there's no legal avenue for them to stop this. And I just wonder, Joe, have we got to a point where certain companies are outside the...
You've touched on a really fundamental problem about the role of certainly large transnational corporations in the modern world, and basically there's a real issue about undermining the sovereignty of states. That's the point you're making, and so there's no easy solution to it. There are some very major corporations that operate across jurisdictional lines, transnational lines. And holding them accountable by conventional methods, taking them to court, for example, or other mechanisms, that's increasingly going to feel unsatisfying. And I think what's going to have to be explored more energetically, more than it's already being explored, is an intergovernmental arrangement to help make these entities accountable. But I think it's a major issue.
Does anyone else want to comment on this topic?
I mean, I might just say from an investment point of view, like most of these companies are the highest performing companies in global stock markets this year. All of you probably own them through your superannuation. And, you know, what we've been saying is this change in the world, this disruption that we're talking about for the next couple of days will manifest in a whole lot of different ways. One of them is more intrusive government squeezing corporate margins. Right, so the world's been through this cycle before, not with the same technologies, but after the boom of the 1920s, we went into a phase in the US of trust busting, which was all about re-regulating corporates that were unfettered because it wasn't working for society. And I expect, we're already seeing it, that the world, or at least, you know, developed economies, democracies, will go through some sort of social contract review with their populations, with their companies, to work out what's acceptable and what isn't, and ultimately, compared to today, that will impact corporate margins.
Yeah. And who are the corporations there for? So I think that there are very fundamental questions. Are they for the shareholders? Are they there for society? I absolutely take your point, Raph, that many of us benefit directly or indirectly from the activities of some of these major corporations, and that's fine from a strictly financial point of view. But we all know, I think the economists call it negative externalities. There's a lot of bad stuff happens as a result of the activities of these corporations, and that's contributing to inequality and to harms in our society and community that have to be addressed. And so we need to, you know, pull some levers to, I think, recalibrate, which I think was your last point.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there's a question over here. We have some working microphones now, or at least one.
Hi. It was interesting to hear.
Sorry, could you? Is that Maile Carnegie?
Yeah, it's Maile Carnegie.
Yes, sorry.
ANZ Bank. Yeah.
It had retail banking at the ANZ.
Yeah.
Is that the ANZ?
Yes.
Oh, right.
It was interesting to hear your comments about the potential chilling effect of regulation on innovation. I'd also be interested to hear how you think about the potential flow-on cost of regulation to the consumer and whether we're getting to a point where it might be exacerbating particularly the intergenerational divide between the affordability of financial services to younger or less wealthy consumers.
Well, that sounds like one for you, Joe.
Well, a lot of fundamental questions wrapped up in that those series of questions. There's no such thing as a free lunch. The fact of the matter is we have a lot of regulation that's designed to protect consumers and investors, and that comes at a cost. Now, in the end, it's a profound policy decision, a matter, and a matter for government in the end as to which, you know, regulatory lever one pulls. I think the cost benefit of regulation, I personally don't think we're that good at it in Australia. I've been doing this for a long time. Anyone who tries to pick up the Corporations Act had better go to the gym first, and certainly don't expect it to be written in a language that's readily digestible even by highly educated English speakers. So we're really grappling with a big problem of complexity. So I think regulation is good. I think I can't imagine a society that hasn't got regulation. I think it's a hallmark of a civil society. It's sort of like the echo of the rule of law. But having said that, our society has to be accessible to everyone. And I think we are now at risk of having a very complex set of regulatory arrangements where unless you're a major business well-resourced, it's very hard to comply. And secondly, a lot of the arrangements are there intended to be there for the benefit of consumers. And they're not finding it that easy either to access the system. I don't think there's any easy answer to those questions, but I think it's appropriate that as a society and a community, we at least acknowledge that we have this challenge. That in my remarks already this morning, we're talking about climate disclosure changes. That's going to affect everybody, not just the big end of town. By the time 2027, 2028 rolls around, many thousands of Australian companies are going to have to comply with some really challenging standards where we're at the early stages of figuring out what they mean and how they're going to be implemented. So I think they're all good questions with no easy answers.
Now, we have one last question on the panel here in front of us. It's for you, Michelle. It appears that monetary policy as a tool is increasingly contested, given those that are spending, brackets, mainly older Australians, are not impacted by rate rises. How do you think of that challenge?
So a couple of points. Monetary policy actually works. We know it works and it is working. It's in a restrictive phase and we know that it is dampening spending. We also know, and we've said it before, it's a blunt tool and it affects different people differently. Having said that, there's a lot of focus in Australia on what we call cash flow channel, which is what this particular question is referring to, in that people who have debt are impacted by rate rises. And in Australia, it impacts quickly and strongly because we have variable rate debt in Australia and many other countries have much more fixed rate debt. United States, for example, 30-year mortgages, interest rates don't impact them in that sense. So what that tells you, though, is that monetary policy doesn't just operate through the cash flow channel, because it works in other countries where they don't have as strong a cash flow channel. And it works here as well. It works through what economists call intertemporal substitution. So as interest rates rise, people are incentivised to save rather than to spend. And that also impacts older Australians. They earn more if they save, so they're incentivised to save. In fact, people with mortgages are also incentivised to save because the more they stick in their offset account, the less they pay on their mortgage. So there's that channel. And the final channel is the exchange rate channel. And if we don't increase interest rates, you could imagine, as other countries increase their interest rates, our exchange rate would be going down and that would be adding to inflation. So I just want to make the point, again, that monetary policy has a useful role to play. The Treasurer also commented that fiscal policy needs to be working in the same direction as monetary policy, and that's positive. But the idea that monetary policy isn't useful anymore, I don't buy that.
Well, thank you, Michelle. Now, before I thank the panel, I just remind you we're going to break for morning tea. Plenary session two will resume here at 11:30. And the tea and coffee will be served outside in the lounge area. But if you could just join me in thanking Jo Longo, Raphael Arndt, Michelle Bullock and Danielle Wood. Thank you.
Well done, Tony.
Good warm-up.